Hi, I'm Jennifer Ackerman Haywood, and you're listening to the Craft Sanity Podcast, an interview show about art, craft, and creativity. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Craft Leftovers Monthly Zine. Head over to craftleftovers.com/shop to order your copy of this month's zine. It's filled with original projects, recipes, tips, stories, and crafty puzzles, all about using what's on hand. So head over to craftleftovers.com/shop to get your copy. This episode of the podcast is also sponsored by tortagala.com, where you'll find Linda's handmade leather journals and see her wonderful illustrations and graphic design work, and also read her wonderful blog. This episode is also sponsored by Swell Cloth. Head over to swellcloth.etsy.com for a selection of fabric, patterns, and notions for the modern sewist. Craft Sanity listeners are going to receive 10% off their total purchases using the code CSL10. Okay, so let's get to it, folks. It's time to craft sanity. Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 121 of the podcast. Sorry it took me so long to get this one out. I've been kind of on a little craft adventure making the first issue of Craft Sanity magazine. So I will tell you more about that in the after show. It's going to be available this Tuesday, December 7th, 2010. So it's coming soon. But right now I want to focus your attention on my guest, Betsy Timmer. Betsy Timmer is an artist that I met during Art Prize 2010 here in Grand Rapids, Michigan. She came all the way from Kansas to enter her rag rug piece. It was called rag rug. It was not exactly a rag rug. It was a dress constructed like a rag rug that, when it hit the floor, flared out into a rag rug. It captured my attention when I walked through the Grand Rapids Art Museum and saw it. And I was thrilled to get a chance to meet up with Betsy and record an interview. One of the most impressive things is she placed in the top 75 of more than 1,700 pieces. So she had a really exciting experience where she was actually ranked in the top 100 and ended up finishing in the top 75. And they don't tell you exactly where you finish, even within those categories. They only reveal the top 10 people, and then you learn the placement of those people at the end of the competition. But everybody else is just out there, and you don't really know what your rank is unless you're in the top 100, and then you only know, they say, top 100, top 75, top 50, top 25. So that's kind of how this competition goes. But I'll tell you, Betsy is actually from Michigan, like me. She's from Cadillac, and she currently lives and works in Lawrence, Kansas. She went to the University of Kansas to get a Master of Fine Arts, and her emphasis was in expanded media, and she'll explain what that means during the interview. Before that, she went to Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, Michigan, where she earned her Bachelor of Fine Arts, and her emphasis there was painting. So she has an interesting background, and she uses a lot of craft techniques to create her fine art pieces. So I think this will be a particular interest to those who are just obsessed with the art versus craft and the difference between art and craft, and when art or when craft can become fine art and vice versa, with that whole question of, you know, the difference and the similarities, and it doesn't really even matter. Keep in mind that Betsy and I are in a coat closet for this interview. We each were sitting on chairs holding microphones because we were interrupted multiple times trying to do an interview at the Grand Rapids Art Museum during Art Prize, and we kept moving. And eventually we ended up in a coat closet, which was a curious place. And I think if I remember correctly, the security guard came past and kind of did a double take. But then just kind of looked in and thought, we looked kind of official with these giant microphones and recording device. So I think he was pretty secure in his thinking that we weren't going to like try to plot to rip off some kind of piece of art. We were preoccupied with chatting about art. So anyway, it was a completely ridiculous scenario, though, under which to subject someone to an interview. But Betsy was very, very kind. So anyway, that was just a side note. So I hope you enjoy the interview as much as I enjoyed doing the interview. Here we go.
I live in Lawrence, Kansas, and I moved out there from Michigan about 5 years ago to work on my Master of Fine Arts at the University of Kansas. So We moved there, and it was a three-year program, and I actually specialized in a strange major they have there called expanded media, which is just, I'd call it an umbrella major for everyone that doesn't fit into, I guess, one of the classic disciplines such as painting or sculpture or printmaking. And at the time, I had come from an undergrad, a painting undergrad, and I felt like I was making shadow boxes and collages with found objects, and I entered in as a painter, but I didn't really fit in painting, and I didn't really fit in sculpture, and I didn't really fit in fibers because I didn't have a background in any of those other areas. So I found my way into expanded media, which expanded media at KU includes installation, video artists, animators.
Oh, wow.
Digital, like some of the professors that teach it, they collage digitally using Photoshop. So that was my major. But really, I guess for myself, I just gravitate toward whatever media I need to get my ideas out. So I don't feel limited. Like if I need to paint tomorrow, I can do it. If I need to work with textiles, I can do it. And I don't really feel limited like that. But anyway, so I graduated from KU a couple years ago. And ever since then, I've been working as an adjunct, teaching drawing one and two, figure drawing, and foundation stuff like 2D design and 3D design. And to supplement that kind of irregular income, I also do some graphic design, like lots of little logos and icons and labels for products. And I primarily work for a company in the Detroit area here in Michigan.
Oh,
that,
really?
That I connected with when I lived here.
Oh, okay.
So I still have this ongoing relationship with them, which supports my art dreams. So.
Yeah, well, that's really great, too, because a lot of us need to have things to support our art dreams.
Yeah.
It's a reality for a lot of people.
It's hard because I would much rather work with my hands. I think that's one thing I've learned from doing so many graphics that I feel, you know, I like to work with my hands more than anything. So hopefully I'm maneuvering to someday be doing that totally.
Well, I'd say that you're on the right track. I mean, I think too, for the people that didn't come to Art Prize, you know, I can just fill them in here. This is the best venue. Like, I mean, to be in the art museum, there's a lot of great venues, not to slam any of the other venues.
Yeah.
I'm in another venue and not in this venue, but I think this is like what all the artists want to be here.
Yeah.
Because this is the art museum.
Yeah, I definitely did. The lighting, the floor, the beautiful
walls,
and just the location is awesome.
So it must be kind of cool to see your piece. Have you ever shown work in a place like this before?
No, I've never been in a museum before. So
yeah.
I kept saying, this is the best place my work has ever been. This is the best place my work has ever been. If nothing else, you know, I'm so excited just for the photo I'm going to get.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, piece,
for your portfolio.
You know?
Yeah. And let's talk a little bit about the piece that you made for Art Prize. Or what did you make it for Art Prize, or was this something you were just working on?
Yeah, it's just something I'm working on. I have a really hard time in general. Like if I see a call for work for a specific show, I'm never the person that starts making a piece for that show. I always just, you know, it has to happen that I have a piece for the show.
Okay, so if it fits in.
Yeah, if it fits, I send it. If it doesn't fit, I don't try to adjust myself to fit the show. But actually, this piece, I was working on it last summer, and it wasn't quite done. And my husband really wanted me to apply because his family and friends kept saying, Art Prize, Art Prize.
Oh, because did they come and
see?
Yeah,
they knew about it. They knew about it last year. I didn't get it done in time, and there was other scheduling things, and I just was not on board with driving it from Kansas to Michigan, and it seemed stressful.
Because how long did that take?
To drive here?
Yeah.
It takes about 12 hours.
But then you 11. Have this huge dress. I mean, how do you travel with that?
The braided fabric is one continuous piece. One continuous braid, and that is all one piece, but it slides over top of this armature that is made out of foam.
Okay, and I don't know if we describe for people that like basically a dress. Well, I'll let you describe.
Yeah, it's a form that is simultaneously a rug and a dress, and it's made the old-fashioned rag rug way, strips of cloth that are ripped and braided together, and then the braids are sewn together around and around to make the form. So I guess if you can imagine just a gown, like a standard-looking evening gown kind of flares out at the skirt, and it just flows into the ground and becomes a dress or a rug.
Yeah,
a rug.
And it's funny because it did. When I looked at it, I thought of a wedding dress.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because I know at my wedding I felt like it was the biggest dress I've ever worn. And it was dragging on the ground, and it was, like, blackened. Like, the silk border on the bottom of the dress was, like, black by, like, within minutes, it seemed like. And that's kind of starting to happen, where people are actually, like, stepping on the rug, which they shouldn't be doing.
Which they shouldn't be doing, but it's strangely fitting.
Yeah, and it's really, it's kind of, and this is a different kind of competition, too, in the sense that a lot of the people that are viewing the artwork, it's more of interactive, or people are treating it as interactive, even when perhaps they shouldn't.
And some of the work, I mean, you could see that, too, that they could get confused, or not confused, but just not, you know, some of the work out there you're supposed to touch.
Right.
And it's labeled that way, and some of it you're not supposed to.
And sometimes people don't.
Yeah, like, they don't realize they switched from the do not touch zone to the touch zone and then back again.
Right, because there was actually, I don't know if, I don't think I saw the photo, but I heard that someone had taken a picture, like, standing on the rug behind the dress, like, as close to the dress part as they could get, but their arms up, like, looking like they're wearing a dress, a man wearing. Yeah. Well, that's a funny idea. I was, like, kind of cringing for you.
Yeah.
Like, oh, geez, this is, you spent, how long did it take to do this?
That, I always joke and say I never keep track of that because it's depressing, but I don't know. I really don't know. It just, it was something I would work on, you know, when I finally got done working, I would try to work on it a couple hours a night. Mm-hmm. And I worked on it for months and months. And I actually, usually I get an idea and sometimes I don't engineer it totally properly the first go. So I've actually taken that apart, the, at least half of it I've taken apart a couple times and redone it.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Just trying to figure out the best way to sew it. And
because you want your stitches to be, because I mean, it's really, it's well constructed.
I mean, you want it to hold together. And when I started, I was trying to go through the strips, like actually pierce the strips with a needle. And because it's such a, it's a, each strip is about 6 inches wide. So when you compress it and braid it, it's actually pretty sturdy and hard to put a needle through.
Right, yeah.
And so I was buying all these industrial, like, thimbles, you know, like they're leather thimbles with metal, and they were breaking. And I was actually, for a while, I was actually having to use a pliers to push the needle through and to pull it out.
And it's so time consuming.
Yeah, and then I found a new technique where I used a big flat needle and I actually went around the strip instead of piercing through it.
Oh,
and then that increased my speed. But I had to go back and take out all the
previously
because I wanted it to match.
Right.
So, and then when I started it as well, I didn't know if I was going to need a really heavy duty armature or if it would hold itself up maybe somehow.
Oh, right, right.
And I didn't, when I started it, I didn't know if it was going to be closer to the floor or more standing. You know, so it has been, usually when I make something, I feel like I end up making it a couple times by the time I'm done.
Right.
To tweak it and make sure the craft is good and it looks how I want. Because sometimes I feel like when you plan something out in your head, if you're too set with that plan, you can't respond to what's happening when you actually start working with the materials.
Exactly.
So I have to try to be flexible and not get too married to my idea. So it can't change as it needs to. So.
Right. And I think there's something kind of liberating, too, when you do, when you are willing to let go. Like, you have the plan in your head, and you kind of you start working on it, and you realize, like, oh, actually, this could be a lot better if I tried this. Or maybe what you thought would work doesn't work.
Yeah.
And sometimes people just throw in the towel at that point, and they get really frustrated. But I kind of like getting swept up in that wave that kind of carries me someplace else. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be kind of scary, though, too, especially when it involves ripping out stitching.
Hours of work. My most recent piece that I made is a mop, the mop dress that I was showing you.
Right, it looks really cool.
It's made, basically, it's strings of mop cotton that are all measured and then attached to a dress body that's made out of latch hook canvas. And when I started this one, you know, I just loosely sewed the latch hook canvas, not really looking at how that canvas was made. I loosely sewed it into the dress form around an actual dress mannequin.
Okay.
And I started attaching the strings, and I started at the bottom, and I started working up. And as the strings kept getting longer and I attached, I mean, there's thousands probably, maybe, at least hundreds of strings. I think it was 200 strings to go around the circumference one time.
Oh, my goodness.
And as I started to get more and more strings, it started to get heavier and heavier. And that was something I hadn't even considered because, you know, usually you just grab string and you don't even think of its weight. But if you grab 1,000 strings, suddenly it's very heavy.
Right.
And so the way the latch hook canvas was constructed, it was pretty loosely woven. And so as the weight started to pull, it started to shift. And then my loose stitches that were holding the dress body together started to pull against the canvas.
Oh, okay.
And the latch hook canvas, and it started to come apart.
Oh.
And so I was putting the thing on because I was excited I could actually wear this piece, and a hole started in the side.
Oh, no.
And I just sat there and looked at it, and I thought, oh, I have to take this whole thing apart. And it took me, once I realized it, I'm kind of a perfectionist in a way, and I know, I mean, I cannot handle the stress of shipping something somewhere and then knowing that if somebody moves it the wrong way, it's going to break.
So I knew
for the longevity of the piece that I had to take it apart. And I knew economically I had to carefully take it apart because I need to reuse those strings because I can't afford to go buy. Like, I'd like to take the whole thing and put it in the dumpster and never see it again and start over. But yeah. I really needed to carefully unknot each string and keep them organized by length and then build the whole thing again. But it took me... Once I realized it, it took a few days before I was willing to go there, just like to get mentally prepared for, I know you just spent hours and hours putting it together, but now you're going to take it apart. But it's worth it because now, you know, it's something I have a fair amount of confidence in its construction.
Right. And so, now you know it's going to stay together.
Yeah.
And it's gonna
Yeah. But I sometimes wish I could, I don't know why I work like that. Like, I get the idea and then I go for it. But then oftentimes, especially with these big projects, I've never braided a rug dress before, or I've never made a mop dress before, and there aren't instructions online for it or anything, so just kind of have to figure it out as you go.
Yeah, well, I think that I know with the most recent project I just did where I used neckties to make a quilt, or five quilts, it was supposed to be one, it turned into five, and had I known what that was going to be like, I would never have done it. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, and I think
working
it's kind
with that fabric.
Well, I just think how long it took. And, you know, I got myself into a situation where I had like a month to take them from like a stack of blooms to a finished piece. And I just think that sometimes not knowing, like you not knowing how the mop dress, like how long it was going to mm-hmm. take. And like, oh my gosh, at one point there's going to be a gaping hole in the side. And you're going to have to start over. Like, if we knew all that at the beginning, we probably would talk ourselves out of these things. Mm-hmm. Do you feel the same way? Like, we're not knowing sometimes is a good thing?
Yeah, sometimes it is a good thing, and I think I naturally go for processes that somehow, I mean, even taking these things apart and redoing them, when I'm feeling stressed, sometimes I'll time myself, like, how long does it take me to do 200 strings one time around the dress?
Mm-hmm.
I'll time, and I know, okay, that took 45 minutes, so this is going to take me about 8 hours to get to here. Like, if I really need to know,
right,
because I'm running out of time, I sometimes do things like that just a little bit. But in general, I think usually the processes I end up doing, I usually end up falling in love with them. And they're the mm-hmm. time that I spend doing them is a real meditative time where my brain just goes
mm-hmm.
and it goes hither and yon. I mean, there's not a set thing I think about. Sometimes it's art, sometimes it's personal life, sometimes it's, you know, world issues. It's anything and everything in between. Sometimes I don't remember what I was thinking about, but just having that time to be quiet and just let your brain go,
mm-hmm.
I think some of that makes me not even care about how long it takes. Like, I really don't care. I don't think about if I sold this piece for $3,000, I would make 4 cents an hour or something. I don't think about that
right.
at all. Doesn't
well, I
matter.
Think if that mattered, then
nobody,
you would be doing something else.
Yeah.
But what about the part that comes in between ending a project and starting a new one? The part where you show your project, the finished project. Because
mm-hmm.
in your case, you had this rug dress mm-hmm. in your living room for a long time.
Yeah.
And people would come over and see this thing and be like, what's going on?
Uh-huh.
And when you finally get it done and you show it to people, like, how do you get nervous about that, or are you excited about that, or what is your response when you get it done and you're presenting it to your public?
You know, I'm kind of recovering from grad school still, which sounds funny because it's been 2 years, but of trying to get back in the swing of balancing full-time job or several part-time jobs and still trying to make art and just really being totally, I guess, disillusioned or disappointed in your current schedule after 3 years of grad school where your full-time job was to go to your studio and make art, you know, 40 hours a week or more. That's what I did for 3 years. So I feel really like I move very slow now because I just don't have the time to commit. And another thing, in grad school, you have all these faculty and all these students around you telling you every day if they like what you're doing or not, or if they like what you're thinking about or not, or if your ideas are valid or,
right,
you know, and now, and then you graduate and you're back sewing things together in your living room and no one looks at them except your cat and your husband and everyone's sick of it, including yourself sometimes. And
right.
So it is, sometimes it's a little nerve-wracking because you wonder, like the insecure part of me wonders, is this good? Is this done? What if people think this is stupid? And, you know, so there's a little bit of fear, but usually I can, you know, usually I'm only satisfied if it's okay, you know, like
right. You don't strike me as a person who was put some, yeah, some try low quality
put
piece
something
out there.
Out there.
Yeah, you're like, the last person that's gonna
I
do that.
I can't do that. And so, you know, usually my husband has an art degree, so he'll give me, you know, he's sometimes painfully critical, and which is great. Which,
yeah,
because
if he was blowing smoke in your face and then you went out in public, you'd rather have
terrible.
It. You'd rather hear it in your living
so
room.
So I usually have. He usually gives me his opinion and. You know, just you got to put it out there. And then when I get it out there, usually I get really positive feedback from
right.
people. And then I just feel very excited to show people my work, you know. And,
yeah.
And it is funny how, you know, one stranger coming up to you and saying that they connect with what you do, or one email coming into your inbox after all these hours of work, makes it all worth it. You know, I'm never one to worry. Well, I make kind of strange forms that most people wouldn't want in their living room. So, you know, I don't usually sell work, and I try not to worry about that too much. So even just one comment coming from some random person is just like gold to me. And it just makes it feel like it's all worthwhile.
Yeah. Well,
really,
it's to have the validation from someone
really,
who doesn't have to.
It's not like my
not
mom.
Obligated.
Yeah, it's not like my mom who wants to not hurt my feelings or, you know,
right.
Somebody that who I value out. Their opinions and I love their feedback, but it's different when it's someone that doesn't have a personal connection to you.
Right. They're not obligated to be supportive.
Exactly.
You know, it's so for people, the folks at home listening, you know, if you can take us back a little bit to your creative roots and maybe help us glean some tidbits that might be useful as we all, the rest of us, pursue our you know, artistic goals as well. So I know when we had talked a little bit previously, we've tried to like do this interview a couple times. You were interrupted by a band that like struck
in the museum
up, like,
closing.
Yeah, this, the closing announcements last night. Yeah, so we've this is like take three, I think we're on. But you were talking a little bit about your childhood and as kid. It's like it sounds like you were always making stuff.
I was the coloring book kid or the paper and crayon kid and not the Barbie girl. But I guess when we moved from northern Michigan, which was largely rural, where there weren't a lot of art classes in the school that I was going to be going to for K through 12th grade.
Okay.
There was a 10th grade art, and then there was 12th grade art, and there was just normal art projects in elementary. So around 6th grade, I started taking some art lessons with the high school art teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And then my dad ended up transferring to the Detroit area, and I ended up landing in a school district where my junior high had art classes both years, and then in high school, I actually had 3 full-time art teachers.
Oh my goodness.
In one building.
What district were you in?
I was in the Utica Community Schools in Sterling Heights, Michigan.
Yeah.
And so I had some really great art teachers, and I was able to, by my senior year, I was able to basically fill my schedule with art.
Wow.
Kind of, you know, much to the chagrin of my dad, who thought I should be able to fit in more calculus and physics. But I did. I got to take a vocational, 3-hour block of commercial art, like graphic design kind of class. And we had specific drawing classes, art history classes, 3D art classes. And that was really great. And that set me on my way to think that I could do art in college. I set out for college going to Western Michigan University because I got a really great scholarship there through the Honors College. That's why I went there, even though I really wanted to go to a real art school. Like, I thought I had to go to real art school. I went to WMU, and it turned out totally great. And I thought I wanted to do graphics. That's what I told myself and others, because it seemed really impossible to say you want to be an artist. Just the practical side of me thought, you can't be an artist. Why would you you know, go to school for it. It just sounded scary. But I got to the point where I was filling out my graphic design application, and I was having the hardest time writing an essay about how bad I wanted to be in the program, because I didn't really want to be in the program that bad.
And it does make it difficult to
write something. It does make it difficult. I'm not a good liar, so I was having issues. But my figure drawing professor, Don King, he just gave me a talk one day about, you know, why don't you really try to go for it in painting? And, you know, I really respected this man. I thought he was amazing, and that's just what I did. And that's not to say I sometimes don't have, you know, those days where I'm like, why didn't I go for engineering or nursing or something reliable? Because it gets exhausting to always be kind of wondering what you're going to do. But I know that happiness is worth a lot. And so it's good. I'm always telling students, okay, you have to just follow your heart. You know, you don't know what's going to come. And lots of people do not end up working in the field that they got a degree in. Really, it's true. So
yeah. And I think if you just go to college, and I mean, because today college really is, there's few people that are able to skip college and go on to whatever they want to do, just because the way our society is set up. You really need to have some college if you can get your hands on a degree, you know, do it. But it sounds like you really enjoy what you're doing.
Yeah.
And the freedom you have to make whatever you want.
Yeah, I would. I mean, my goal is, I mean, strangely enough, after undergrad, I just started doing more and more graphic design, which is not my love, but it is something that can bring you a paycheck. And then after doing that for 2 years, I thought, I'm going to lose it. You know, I want to make art. I'm wasting my life. What am I doing? And that was the motivation to go to grad school.
Okay.
So, and then we moved to Kansas because I got a great offer at the University of Kansas. It's 3 years long, which is great. And you get some grad programs are condensed into 2 years.
Right.
And it just changes everything, because you don't have as much time to experiment and try new things.
Because almost
when you hit the ground running, it's like you should be working on your thesis almost when you get there.
And you haven't had time to explore.
You haven't
anything.
Had time to, you know, have a breakthrough or do anything like that. So that was a really great thing. I mean, it was such a great experience to be able to just focus on your work for such an extended period of time.
Were you teaching during that point too, or were you?
You teach one class after. At the time it was set up, you taught one class after you'd been there a year.
Okay, so they give you time. Because a lot of programs, you get in there and you're teaching, like, drawing to undergrads or
something. Yeah, and that's really overwhelming, too.
Because you're trying to, like, be a teacher for the first time.
Yeah, and you've never had education classes, because you don't need those for college teaching.
Right,
at that point, you know, you may have not taken drawing one for 10 years. And you may have had a terrible drawing one teacher.
And now you're suddenly the
teacher. Now you're suddenly teaching it, you know, and it seems like, but I don't really draw. I make things out of fabric, you know, and okay, sure, I'll teach drawing, you know, but it is, I mean, that kind of sounds funny. I mean, I am pretty invested in drawing, and I understand the value of it, and I can do it, though it's not what I tend to hang up as my final work. But it's such a, I think you really learn things. You really learn things when you're teaching. And what I have found is that it's such an inspiring process. I mean, there's some, you know, there's some paperwork and there's some stressful things about it. And there's students that don't take their time seriously, which can be frustrating when you're, you know, you're dreaming of having 3 hours to work on art every day.
And
they want to go smoke cigarettes and, you know, text during your class. And you just kind of want to strangle them, because you're like, you're not taking advantage of your time.
Right.
Still, the whole process of getting people excited about art and helping them learn basic skills, how to see the world, how to be sensitive, and how to develop ideas. That's the most exciting thing to do. It's awesome. And I find that I have this teacher voice that comes out, and I'm telling my students, okay, you just need to erase it. If you can't erase it and you need help, I will erase it for you, but you need to erase it, because no matter how big you draw that man's head on this page, if his nose is not the right proportion, it's never going to be right. No matter how great you make the details, if it's fundamentally wrong, it's just not, you know. And so I'm all tough with them and helping them erase their noses that are wrong and misproportioned features. But then when I'm in my studio, you know, on a Saturday or Friday night, you know, tired and trying to get something to go, that voice pops in, you know, and I hear myself encouraging myself, like my speech about how we're just like basketball players. Would you see a basketball player crying if he couldn't shoot a three-pointer if he hadn't practiced all week? No. So you need to practice.
Right.
You know, I hear myself saying these things, and I can apply them to myself, and it's really, it's great. And it's just good to see students just learning, and then, you know, I'm pretty self-critical, so sometimes, you know, I feel like, oh, I'm not a good drawer, or I don't know about these ideas, or I'm somehow behind schedule or not moving along fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see people starting out, and you see how far you have come, or you see how you can draw, or you can see like what they need to improve on, and somehow you can just magically see it, and it's like, oh, that's right, I do, after all these years of schooling and practice, I do have skills that sometimes I don't feel like I have.
Right.
I do have them.
Right.
And it's good to see people struggling and growing and know that, you know, if you keep struggling, you're going to keep growing too.
Right.
Because you
right.
just sometimes it's just when you're isolated, you know, because artists are largely solitary.
Right, right.
It seems, you know.
Because once you're out of school.
Yeah, yeah. Unless like you're sharing a printing press with a group of people. And even then, lots of times people don't share. I think people don't share their struggles very well because they don't want people to know. And then, you know, you walk into the museum and you see this great finished thing. You never, for an artist looking at other artists' finished work, you don't know that they took it apart four times. They
right.
cried for 5 days straight when something malfunctioned or,
right.
you know, their cat, like, clawed through this project and they built the entire thing again. You
right.
know, you don't know
right.
any of that.
Right. And I think those are, like, the most interesting. Because I think the struggle is all part of the work.
Uh-huh.
You know? And so for your work that you did in college, was it related in any way to your current work that you're doing?
Yeah, most of my, I guess when I started out at first, I didn't really know what my work was about. I was just operating in this, you know, making aesthetic decisions, like composing things real intentionally. And I was collecting, I always collect things, like objects from the past that I feel like they have some sort of history or story, you know, things like that I'm attracted to are old linens, old kitchen utensils.
Things that have been used.
Things that have been used. And I tend to go for things old, like from the 40s to the 60s probably,
okay.
before everything got so plasticky.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is the age and the time that has passed and the I think there's more evidence of people using the things. And another part of it is just that those things are still around where,
right.
you know, I have measuring cups today that I got when I got married. One of them's touched a frying pan. It's melted and dented in. I'm going to throw those away.
Right.
But I own measuring cups, you know, in my studio that are super old and dented that somebody kept. So it's just a whole different era where things were I guess it's a cliche kind of, but things were made to last or they were out of materials that weren't so readily disposable.
Right. Everything's disposable now.
Yeah. Yeah.
yeah.
So I was, you know, collecting all these domestic home objects that for the most part were objects that would be used by women, but I didn't want to talk about like anything. Like I had this bad taste in my mouth about feminism in any way because I didn't really understand it. And I thought, you know, if I was a feminist artist, I was going to be, you know, Carolee Schneeman standing up naked, you know, pulling out a scroll. Like I thought, I guess I was sort of scared of that in undergrad.
Right, because
like,
it's such an extreme.
I was traumatized. You know, I did not want to run around naked, but I do want to I do want to make work about being a woman.
And, right.
And
right.
I love being a woman, and I love my husband, and I want to have a home, and I want to have kids, and I want to have a career. I want it all.
Right.
And I didn't know how that fit because I felt like a lot of feminist artists never got married, and they never had kids, and they didn't do a lot of the things that I was already doing. Or
there's like the separation
think, yeah.
from traditional domestic
yeah,
life.
Yeah, I don't hate, and like, I don't hate men, and I don't hate tradition. In fact, I love it,
right,
you know,
right.
and so I had some issues being able to say, like, I'm making work from my young woman of the 90s, 2000s, 2010, whatever we're in now, you know, how do I make work about that? And how can I embrace tradition and talk about what it's like, you know? So that was really the root of my work for a long time, but I didn't know. And I was too afraid to talk about it. I didn't know how to talk about it. And only through grad school, I started to be okay with talking about it after like a couple of years.
What kind of response did you get?
Super supportive. And yeah. That has been really great too, that, you know, people, women my age, older women, younger women, they really connect with my work. Lots of my graduate thesis work, I did a lot of felting, and I tend to project personalities on everything. It's kind of the secret life of Betsy Timmer. Like, you know, I'm way too attached to certain stuffed animals still at almost 30 years old. And, you know, I see personalities in teapots and little chipped cups and all sorts of stuff. And I just am so attached to objects, and some of them for work, artwork, some of them just because that's what I do. I invent stories. So anyway, I started making these weird felted characters that were kind of figurative in a way, but they would, you know, they would have maybe two legs and breasts, but they wouldn't have arms or heads. And the nipples kind of function as eyes, but also, you know, so they're funny.
Yeah.
But they're kind of terrible at the same time.
Yeah, because people would wonder what was going on.
Yeah, and I seem like I feel like I'm always kind of dancing that line where it's almost, this sounds really funny, but, you know, my primary audience for my work is me. Like, I never am thinking about who's going to see it when I make it. I'm just making it because it's coming out of me. And then with this humor, I'm sort of sugarcoating my ideas from myself. So does that make sense?
You know, it does make sense.
So I make these funny things that make it okay for me to talk about, you know, feeling really stressed out about how do I balance, you know, artwork and a career. Because unless I can get my art to be my career, which I'm working on, you know, how do I balance my day job, my dream art job, and my wanting to have a family and a husband. And, you know, I love Martha Stewart magazine, and I really want to hand dye my own Easter eggs with dye made from vegetables I grew in my garden this summer. You know,
right,
like that pressure
right.
I give myself. And, you know, I need to go to the gym and I need to work out, and like all of these different voices and pressures I pick up, some totally imposed by myself, some from the culture.
Right.
You know, I want to talk about these ideas, and I want to do it in a sort of a funny way, because otherwise it's kind of terrible to think about.
Well, I think sometimes we have to shroud our serious concerns and worries in something humorous. I know for me, my sense of humor is my defense mechanism.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And really terrible things happen. I laugh. I do like what I call my like scream laugh, where sometimes I'm laughing because I think it's really funny, and sometimes I'm just like, are you kidding me? Like,
yeah.
You got to be kidding me. Did this really just happen?
Yeah.
And what was your, and I don't have a copy of your statement about this work, but what is it, the message that you, what were you really trying to convey? Like, and I know you work for yourself. I mean, it's not like you were trying to tell the masses something about womanhood, but in this piece where the dress kind of hits the floor and turns into, becomes a just a braided rug, you know, it's seamless, you know, it goes from rug to dress, dress to rug. It's all like just one thing. What does it mean to you, this piece?
Yeah, well, I guess it's just talking about how complicated the whole relationship or the whole role, the woman's role really is, and how it can go back and forth. You know, like there's so many, I guess usually when I'm making forms, I try to make things that are like a poem. Like the more you read it, you know, it
starts
to unfold.
The more you get from it.
Yeah,
okay.
There's not just one right way of looking at it and thinking about it. So when I see that dress, you know, dresses are beautiful and graceful, and I love dresses like that, and that's, you know, I mean, that is kind of the symbol of, like, your wedding day, or, like, these important events, or just this beautiful dress that you get to wear, and it feels great when you're wearing it. But then, this dress in particular, it weighs about 60 pounds, there's 60 pounds of fabric, and you can't really wear it, and if you have it on, you can't really move.
Right.
You know, it weighs you down. So it's this beautiful, awesome thing to wear, but it really limits you. And the same thing with the rug. You know, rug, like these days we mostly have carpet, or
right,
American
right.
way is to have wall-to-wall carpet. But, you know, really a rug provides warmth and comfort for your home.
Right.
You know, it makes it a cozy place. And you have these things that you kind of overlook. They're underfoot. You know, they're trampled on, really, in this case, and they're getting dirty.
Right.
You know, that's the life of a rug. So connecting those two things, you know, to me it was thinking about, you know, if you're, like, maybe you feel trampled sometimes as a woman, or, and you are underfoot, maybe, or to maybe you're being taken advantage of, or you, people don't realize what you're contributing to them, or,
right.
You know, I was just thinking about mothers and wives sometimes, you know, maybe they're not being respected, or their contributions are not being valued at their true worth.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, that whole idea, it's just kind of a fusion of all of those ideas and how you can see womanhood both ways. You know, like, I can really love it and really hate it within 5 seconds mm-hmm. sometimes. Like,
oh,
I'm
yeah.
so excited that I am able to have children, but I feel totally a burden that, oh, 29 years old, I better start thinking about this, and this is going to take a certain amount of life and energy, and it's going to change my entire life.
Right. And for
but it's awesome. It's
right.
a great blessing and a privilege.
Right.
But it's also going to be some serious work. And just
oh, yeah.
that tension.
Well,
that
and,
tension.
And for women too, because, you know, men can be fathers, and it's a different experience where we do have that awesome experience of being able to, like, the child is with you the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And to actually feel your child poking from the inside is, like, crazy weird, you know? But at the same time, like, so wonderful, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so for women, it's like you there is a point where your life as you knew it before is drastically changed
mm-hmm.
physically.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't go to work. For most people, we're not able to pull it off. Like, where you go to work on your lunch break, pop out a kid, jump right back into
go
your normal
back.
Life.
Yeah.
There's, like, you're physically changed, and then
uh-huh.
you have all these, like, emotional issues where you have to decide. You have this child tugging at your heartstrings, like, you want to spend every single second of your life with this baby, you know.
Uh-huh.
And for some people, you know, they might be in a situation financially where they cannot just stay with
yeah.
the child the whole time. They have to go back to work. And even if you don't have to go to work, back to work, you have to make this choice of, you know, so there's all these things. And when, you know, looking at that dress, every woman that walks by it,
mm-hmm.
I mean, there's going to be a different response from men, but every woman
yeah.
that walks by it, that's either been married, wants to be married, you know, has a home.
Yeah.
You know, it's like all these things flash
yeah.
through your head as you're going past it. And you're like, okay, you know, and what it means to me, depending on what point I'm at in a
mm-hmm.
day, could be completely different.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I don't want to make work that somehow excludes men.
Of course not.
You know, but I
right.
think I work from my perspective, which is, you know, me, 29-year-old, former Michigan Midwesterner, you know, Midwestern
yeah.
woman. And, but I think I'm asking people with the pieces just to be sensitive and to reevaluate or reexamine things that we take for granted.
Mm-hmm.
So, or just, I mean, just looking at the form, hopefully, and just taking time to reflect and maybe question your assumptions in some ways. And I think anything that you learn from, maybe from this piece, can be applied, you know, to different, like, you could, I mean, I could do another piece about what it's like to be a man. I mean,
from
if
your
I,
perspective.
Yeah, I mean, that'd be kind of weird because, you know, I'm not one, so I don't really
right.
know. But there's all
right.
sorts of, you know, I know that my husband feels pressure to provide and to get a good job. And, you know, he has his own baggage.
Right, where that is a greater burden on men.
For, yeah,
I mean,
right, right.
Hands down. I mean,
right, and so, like, I don't want to sound unfair. I think that women are in this totally terrible position that men, you know, it's just different.
Yeah. Well, I think
and I can
been
only really talk about my point of view with
exactly.
any accuracy.
Exactly. And
mm-hmm.
I think obviously, I think we probably both can agree that women are in the best time we've ever been in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to actually have the choice.
Yeah.
No one was, it's not like the Mad Men situation
yeah.
where you're like working in this awful
yeah.
environment where you're
yeah.
being manhandled and, you know,
yeah.
where we have choices and there is respect. But the men, though, the one constant that's remained throughout all this time is that if the man is not providing or the lead breadwinner in a family, people do raise their eyebrows,
yeah.
even though it's acceptable for women to go out and make
yeah,
more than
you
men.
Have. A, yeah.
But it's like the pressure remains
mm-hmm.
on men's shoulders
yeah.
to carry their weight and more than that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's an interesting thing, but obviously it comes through loud and clear that your work, it's important to you that it's authentic. Uh-huh. So you're speaking from your point, and I think the most successful artists do that, because if you try to present these contrived things that you don't even know about, you know, it's hard to. So do you have that, what advice do you have for other artists out there, that maybe the people that are in school now or hoping to go on to be a professional artist, what advice do you have for them as they're trying to find their voice? Because it sounds like the first part of you entered graduate school not exactly, as you said, knowing what your work was going to be about, and emerged now with a pretty successful, you know, track record.
And I think it's going to change. Eventually, when I do have a family or whatever the next phase of life is, everything changes all the time. And at least for my work, you know, it doesn't have like a political agenda. It's not fueled really by external events besides what's going on in my life.
Right.
You know, it's always constantly going to be changing. But advice.
Would you say that people should really, if they're not looking to do political art or something that's influenced by the world around them, so it's not a matter of getting inspired by the headlines, if it's just you want to just make art for people, I think it's probably good for them just to make art about what they know.
Yeah.
You know, so you don't have to like go research like the history of World War II if you don't want to. I mean, if you want to, great. You know?
Yeah. When I started in grad school, if people would ask me what my work was about, I really didn't know. And
what did you say? Did you say, I don't know?
No, I knew I was attracted to these found objects, and I knew I was excited about their history, but sort of, but not really. And I was arranging them in these aesthetically pleasing ways. I don't think you necessarily have to know. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, some people work, you know, they think of a great title, and then they build a piece around that. And to me, I find that completely stifling. Like, I almost am superstitious about it. Like, if I title a piece before it's done, I know it's going to explode. And it's going to be, you know, gone. And so I think, on the one hand, it's really important not to worry about what your work is about. Mm-hmm. And now that, you know, I have this work about women's roles, like, how am I going to break free from that and make work about something else? Like, maybe, you know, not getting yourself, I feel like I'm constantly building boxes for myself that I then have to try to break out of. And that I think that's really normal, but we just want to label ourselves, and we want to know what we do. So it's easy to tell people in 60 seconds in an elevator. You want to know that. You want to have an artist statement you can whip out of your back pocket and tell to people that's what you do. It's easy, but that's not really how it works, you know? So I don't know. I took an art theory class, and the greatest thing, we read lots of books, and a lot of it I don't remember, and a lot of it I felt like I couldn't understand. But the greatest thing that I learned was just thinking about artists, thinking about myself as a cultural worker, which what I mean by that is, you know, as an artist, I feel like it's really important to record my point of view, even though it's just me and I'm nobody special, you know, because I am part of this greater culture, and I'm recording what life is like for me and how I feel and how I think about what's going on. If I'm complaining and I'm making negative art, that's okay. I'm recording things that I'm not happy with. If I'm making art that's, you know, paintings of sunsets, and I have time to notice these beautiful sunsets and enjoy them, that is really recording something about my situation, my culture, that I have the luxury of thinking about those things and just noticing beauty, you know, that. So I see all artists as, you know, having this responsibility to just be truthful and follow their dream or follow their visions wherever they go and not really question it. So, you know, when I see that, really kind of empowers me to just go my own way and try not to worry too much about what I'm actually doing, or if I'm making something cutting edge or not. I don't really have to worry about it too much. I'm kind of free from that because I am just being a cultural worker.
Well, you're kind of documenting.
Yeah, I'm documenting. Yeah. And it's really great, too, because I don't know if you've ever had the experience where you open up Art in America and somebody has an amazing piece very similar to what you just drew in your sketchbook last night that you haven't made yet.
Right.
And it's already there in print. And, you know, sometimes people, artists complain about, man, that person stole my idea.
When they couldn't have possibly.
Yeah, when they couldn't have possibly. And I'm always really, you know, if I'm not feeling like complaining that day, you know, it's exciting. It's like, oh my gosh, this woman in California is making dresses too. She's thinking about dresses as houses. And to me, it seems like, wow, you know, I'm really like tapping into this kind of collective consciousness that's going on. Like, women all around the country are disillusioned like me. We've been raised with the idea that we can do somehow the word anything. You can do anything got exchanged with you can do everything.
Right. And then we're struggling.
And now we're struggling
with
trying to do everything when it's really impossible. And it's really awesome to see other people are thinking the same thoughts. And, you know, you can see how there are movements in art throughout history and throughout time, and we're in the middle of one right now that maybe we can't identify because we're in it. But it's really, I don't know, I think that's so exciting. So, I don't know. So for advice, I just feel like, you know, to be demanding of yourself and don't settle for work that you're not really proud of. But other than that, I just feel like you have to follow your heart. That sounds kind of cheesy, but follow your vision. Don't be afraid. And don't worry if it's not selling and if people maybe don't understand you. You can't really, I try not to think about that.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the work. If it means something to you and you're feeling fulfilled mm-hmm. by it, then that's a good sign.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes I see this a lot with people in the like handcraft realm where, a lot of my listeners are people that have, you know, Etsy shops and they make things to sell. And, sometimes the thing they really enjoy making doesn't sell. So then they have to adjust and start making a bunch of stuff that they don't like to make really, mm-hmm. maybe isn't fulfilling, but it sells. It's a way to pay the bills, still mm-hmm. be a work at home, you know, be able to work at home. And it's kind of this struggle. And, you know, artists tend to be the people that are less willing to compromise because if you're making your art and it's for you and it's not selling, but it's really important for you to make it, like there's this compulsion or drive to do it.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of have to answer that, you know, mm-hmm. you kind of have to do it, you know, but I do want to talk about on this, it's been an exhaustive question on these 100 plus episodes that I've done of this show, where I talk about the difference between art and craft and the uh-huh. overlap, and it seems totally appropriate with you, given the fact that you're using, in this particular piece, it was braided fabric, which is traditionally the way to make a braided rug. You also did like latch hook components. Did you actually latch hook the
I
way?
I couldn't fit the hook through with the mop.
So you just did it, but did you latch it through? Like
yeah, I did.
Just like you would a latch hook rug. So you're using craft techniques.
Yeah, and I always do that. Lots of sewing and felting. And
mm-hmm. So at what point, and I know it's really hard to, this is a question that's never resolved, so I'm not putting pressure on you to answer this definitively, because neither one of us can, because it's just a question that really involves individual, you know, everyone has an answer for themselves, mm-hmm. but at what point do you consider it? Like if you're, I don't know if you do knit or crochet or do any.
I try. I'm really bad at
that. Okay. Well, you do some stitching evidently. Yeah. So at what point do you think that do you consider like a craft technique that you maybe have been doing since you were a kid? At what point do you think it elevates itself to being art as opposed to craft?
Yeah. It's, you know, it's a really good question, and I want to have an Etsy site really bad. Like, I go on Etsy every single day, and I rarely buy things because I try not to buy stuff.
Well, because, we're all kind of
because we don't have
like,
a lot of money.
Yeah, I know, I understand.
But I, like, have this vision of me, like, making things and selling them, but I don't know what to make, which sounds really weird.
Well, because there's a lot of crafters out there that make things and sell them, but they want to make art, but they don't know what to make.
Yeah, but it's like you know, I think, okay, I'm a good sewer. I'm like, okay, I'd like to make tote bags. I'm going to make hundreds of tote bags that are really awesome, really great fabrics. I'm going to sell them. Or lately I've been thinking I'd like to learn how to do leather working and make shoes, which sounds really silly. But, you know, I guess I see that making multiples of objects for other people that don't have this greater, like, they don't have a message or they don't have this intention beyond being a shoe or being a purse.
Right.
To me, then it becomes a craft. And then I think, okay, well, if you're going to make 100 purses, you are still going to have to do art when you're done with 100 purses. So that's, like, I'm kind of searching for this magical place where I happen to want to make, you know, I happen to make little miniature art that still fulfills my artist self, but somehow people want to buy it. Like, I almost seem like for me to start mass producing a craft, it's just going to be another job. And I'll still want to do art.
Right, so it won't fulfill you in that way.
Yeah, so but so when I think about it, there in one hand, there isn't a difference in terms of skill and materials. There can be. There doesn't have to be. I'm not a purist that thinks you can't turn acrylic yarn into amazing art that should be like in the Metropolitan or something.
Oh, yeah,
something.
There's some people out there doing some amazing things.
Yeah, there's amazing things. And I'm real interested in taking traditional techniques because they carry with them all of this history and all of this like value because of the traditions of women.
Right.
You know, like using a braided rug carries with it all of this history that would be totally lost if I, you know, I guess I could maybe make the dress out of carpet, like Berber carpet, you know.
Right.
I cut it and I seamed it perfectly and it's
right.
just like a carpet that goes out. That would have a whole different meaning because
right.
it doesn't speak about the hours and the time and the recycling of the used materials and
right.
all of that wouldn't be there. But so I don't think that there's like a line in the sand, like if you start crocheting, you are in the craft category. It's not that, but I think it is something about how people think about the point of their work.
Right. Right.
So I know it's a fuzzy area. And right now I don't know if people are just reacting against everything being so commercial and so slick and so plasticky and I'm going to say made in China, but not to pick on the Chinese, but just that manufactured.
Well, it's not made here.
Yeah.
It's not made locally.
Yeah,
and I think
it's
no
like
matter where
anonymous.
You are, whether you're in China or your Korea or you're
yeah.
listening in, you know, in Michigan, we all, I think, wherever we live, there's a certain pride that you take when you can go to the store and
yeah.
you can buy something that was made by a craftsperson
yeah,
right in
know,
town.
You know, like to be connected with the person and like all the imperfections that come with handmade things
right.
that aren't perfectly engineered, that maybe there's a drop stitch or maybe it's a little bit
wonky in some
yeah,
way.
Yeah, and just
yeah.
knowing that someone's hands were on this and they knitted the sweater for you and it took 80 hours. You know, there right now it seems like that is really popular. Like Etsy is really popular. I just was at a wedding this weekend where my you know, I would say really normal Washington, D.C. friend. By normal, I mean she's not a creative person, really. She bought all sorts of wedding gifts for her bridal party off Etsy. And she's so excited that they're handmade and that, you know, she's supporting a local a crafter who's doing this for a living. And it just seems like that is something that is really in
our
culture.
It's mainstream
now. Yeah, it's mainstream now.
Because Etsy's been around for a while and you know, it's amazing to me how many people I hear who are not
yeah.
people sitting at home knitting or
yeah.
crocheting or even going to craft shows.
Yeah.
But they heard about, hey, have you heard about this cool
yeah.
site? It's like, yeah, I've been selling on it for a while.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, but it's really cool to see that
yeah.
people are kind of starting to value that again.
Yeah.
You know? And it's not out of necessity. It's
yeah.
choice.
It's choice.
We can't compete with like Target and Walmart
right.
and as individual people. Like if you made 100 tote bags, you would not be able to undersell the rollback
yeah.
at Walmart.
I know.
There's just no way.
uh-huh.
I mean, you would be in the hole if you,
yeah.
if you tried to do that. But yeah, it is really interesting. And what do you think, though, about, I'm interested, like, in your grad school experience, do they talk about selling art? Do they talk
no.
about Etsy? Do they talk about ways to monetize your art in a way that, without compromising what it means to you, you know, and letting go of, like, the reason why you do it? But
yeah.
they didn't talk about that.
No, and I think it seems almost like a dirty word to talk about selling work.
Really?
Yeah, and they didn't pressure you. Not one person I knew complained that she was getting some flack from people about being too focused on her selling her work. And I think in her case, she was just getting really distracted from graduate school
because
you're
she
supposed
was
to be able
work.
To experiment. And she, like those little boxes you build yourself again, you know, she had some successful paintings that were selling, and then you just feel like, okay, well, if everyone wants a green landscape, I better make more of those.
Oh, and if you're in grad school and you're supposed to be exploring
yeah,
all the
she
realms.
She wasn't letting herself do
so
that.
So she was responding to the market.
But yeah, but nobody talks about that. And I think that is a real big difference, too, the divide between art and designers.
Right, because designers are told, like, okay, how do you market
your
work?
Yeah, like, illustrators get the color forecast.
Right.
And then pattern makers get the color forecast, too, and right. try to start
thinking
doing
ahead.
What is going to be in next summer.
Right. You guys are given, like, the critics' forecast.
Yeah,
you know,
we're not
forecast
supposed to. Yeah, we're not. I mean, you're frowned upon if you even seem remotely concerned with that.
Which so how is, do they propose that you make money then? Is it
they
supposed
don't.
To be like a university job kind of
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, I mean,
where you teach and then...
that's kind of presented, strangely, as like the only option. But it's not even, they don't talk about that either.
Because isn't it hard to get a job, a tenured position?
Yeah,
and
like,
I mean, that's got to be
it's
almost
like
unheard of like
hard
in today's
slash
economy.
Impossible.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, right now, lots of departments just aren't hiring because of hiring freezes.
Exactly.
No one has any money. But even on a good day... You know, how many people are graduating with their MFA every semester?
Right.
Hundreds. And, you know, there'll be like 300 jobs in the entire country across all disciplines. And that includes graphic design professors, art history professors, everybody.
So that makes it really hard.
Yeah,
to get...
like you'll get, you'll, like I know I applied for this little job teaching foundations and most faculty wouldn't even want to teach foundations. They want to work with grad students and people
right.
farther along. They don't want to teach people how to do, you know, how to use a ruler and contour line drawings and stuff
right,
every semester.
Right, because that's so basic, right?
Yeah.
And you,
yeah. Like, this is how you make green, you know, every for 20 years.
If it'd be hard to motivate. Very hard to motivate yourself.
But okay. Even that job, I know my rejection letter, you know, you send out your packet and cross your fingers, but my rejection letter said that they had received over 300 applicants for the job.
Goodness.
And that's just standard.
And that's for a job that really is not the most desirable.
Well, yeah.
I mean...
No, like you'd have to move to rural Texas and teach foundations, you know.
Yeah.
Which I could see that. I mean, imagine how many people apply for every job in New York or Chicago or LA.
Right, and this is one that's not on the,
yeah.
the most highly
so,
sought.
So location. I feel, I mean, at least in my program, I feel like it would be worth developing maybe more programs to help people get on their way.
Right.
But I think it's just hard. It's hard to know what to do.
Well, I think, like you said, you're a painter, and I haven't seen your paintings because I've been.
Yeah,
kind
you
of
can't
so
really
focused.
Find them.
I'm like totally
yeah.
transfixed. Oh, yeah. You don't even have them on your website, or
well, they. I just sort of the end of my painting degree. I was starting to work with objects.
Oh,
I was
okay.
Still
so
just
your
in
most
painting.
Current work is going to
yeah.
be okay.
Yeah.
Well, have you ever thought about selling prints though, like of things
yeah.
that you make?
I mean, I see people do that on Etsy.
Because that's one of those things where you make the work once.
And then you can make it affordable.
You can make it, you know, you
and
print
you
it.
Make multiples.
Yes.
Yeah. And I know one person I know on that sells on Etsy, she's a printmaker.
Yeah.
And she is able to make, they're one of a kinds, but they're only like, they're probably like 4x4 inches, but they're little, I guess they're kind of doodles, but they're
yeah.
very charming.
Yeah. And so
and
she's found a market.
Yeah, she has. And she's sold hundreds of them. And it's really working out for her. But I would say she is really fortunate that her vision, you know, her vision for her work has
fits
that
kind of market.
Yeah, and, you know, honestly, I haven't really talked to her about it. I don't know if she feels like, oh, I got to do another 4x4 inch doodle today, you know, so I can
yeah.
sell it for $50. I don't know if she feels like that or if – I think it could easily slip into that.
Well,
know?
I think anytime you're doing anything – I sell weaving looms right now, which was not part of the plan. Like 10 years ago when I started, I was just doing like chenille scarves and rugs and like practical, but yet kind of like I could still kind of be artistic with the scarf,
uh-huh.
you know, kind of thing. So it was like my compromise of like making work
yeah.
that I could sell. Well, I found that it was still really hard to go around to art shows and sell your work and actually make money off of it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like,
it's so hard.
It's really hard to do. So nobody really cared if it was a hand-woven rug because they could go to one of the big box stores and buy one for $5.
Yeah.
So why are they going to pay $25 to get yours?
Right.
You know, and you still feel like you're underselling, you know,
mm-hmm.
like you're not pricing it right.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided that instead of trying to sell finished pieces, a bunch of stuff, I would try to just make looms. And it was kind of a crazy way that this came about.
Yeah.
But then there are fine artists on Etsy who have been able to reach a market that is, I don't know how much high-end art is being purchased on there. I haven't really
yeah.
done a search recently to see
yeah.
with a tag art, like, what is selling and if big pieces are selling.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if your dress, if you put
it
up there,
yeah, it
what
seems
would
like, how could you sell that?
Yeah, that would be so hard because mm-hmm. they couldn't see it. And then how do you ship it?
Right.
And it would be kind of crazy. But I think that it's definitely, if more art students, I do always tell art students about it. You know, if I see somebody walk past and they're like, oh, mm-hmm. I'm an illustrator or whatever. I'm like, oh, well, you should... You know, think about it. Like, you can make little magnets, you know, print your work that you've already created and make it into a switch plate and sell it, you know, and then they're able to fund the work they really want to do and take the body of work you've already created.
Yeah. And even just as another promotional tool, like, I've thought, I mean, it's really cheap to put stuff on Etsy. And I thought, you know, what? So what if I, maybe I should, when this art prize is all done and I'm settled back in to normal life, you know, maybe it will be worth it for me just to post a few pieces. And then if they get in a treasury, you know, I'll get more clicks on my website.
Right.
And, you know, I know that designers at big firms and things.
Oh, they're looking.
They're looking.
They are totally
looking.
To
see what's out there. And so that is just another, it's almost like a very affordable website that you could have for yourself.
Right.
You know, and it's probably worth it even if you never sell a thing.
Yeah, it is a great promotion. And the funny part is I make art, like small art pieces that I've never tried to sell any of those on there.
You haven't?
But yet I have. I've sell, and I think for me, I become, and I don't know if this is an issue for you, I could just be totally neurotic, but I become very attached to the things I make.
Oh, like I'm over pieces. It. Yeah.
The art, like, so you're, I bet, over, you're over the dress. Like, if someone walked up and paid you money right now, you could just be like, bye-bye to the
dress. I would be sad.
Yeah.
But after a few experiences of not selling it when I could have, like when I was younger.
Oh, so you've just refused to sell some things.
Yeah, or like submitting, like, or if someone wanted to trade and I maybe didn't really love their piece, I wouldn't trade them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, other artists.
Well, that seems kind of like reasonable.
Yeah, but
I mean,
like,
if you don't love the work.
Or like just things I wanted, things I, like, there in undergrad, there was one piece I really liked that I didn't, I made it not for sale in a show and people kept asking me about it. And I just said, no, it's not for sale. It's not for sale. And then, you know, 10 years later, I don't like hanging my own work in my house at all because I don't know. I just feel weird about that. I'd rather not do that. And, you know, it's in a box and it could be in someone's house.
But right. Where they could be
enjoying
it. It's in a box.
Yeah. So I do, I feel really attached to my pieces. Like I don't like shipping them places because I, you know, they could get broken or get lost, and that sounds terrible. But I know that...
Well, it's a risk anytime you send...
Yeah, but I know that the work I make, if it can get out there and get a life of its own, really, that is what I need to do, because I know that, you know, in a few years I'm going to look at that piece and I'll have moved on from it. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, even right now, like when I go look through the museum, I see amazing, awe-inspiring things. But when I look at mine, I don't feel that because I've just made it, you know, and I'm maybe a little sick of looking at it in a way, or I only see the flaws. Like, I only see the things I would do different if I did it again, which is a good, I think it's a good attitude because it helps you keep pushing to do your best.
Right. And I think it makes you, you're going to grow more and you're going to go further than the person that thinks they're absolutely fabulous.
So
like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because some people just stop growing.
Yeah, I'd never feel like I'm fabulous.
I find like my entire life is going to be a learning process.
Yeah.
I mean, I really want that to be. Yeah. So that's wonderful.
So I know that eventually I'm going to move on from the piece. And even though I'm real attached to it right now, if someone wants it, I have to give it to them, or I have to let it go.
Yeah.
Go out there, represent me, and be with someone that loves it. And then I need the space.
Right, because you're making the next thing. Only got so much space.
Yeah.
Like, because what will the dress, I mean, if you don't end up selling it here or putting it in a collection, what is going to happen to that dress?
I mean, well, for most of this year, it has been, I have a gigantic Rubbermaid container that the dress, I kind of roll it up like a big burrito.
Oh, really?
So and the foam pieces, the armature breaks down into 4 different pieces.
Okay, so you can break it down.
Yeah, but I mean, they're still huge. Like if I redid the armature again, I would make it into even smaller sections.
Right.
So I could store it more easily.
Yeah.
But it just goes in my basement.
So for you, you would rather see it. I mean, I totally get
that. I after having so many things around in store, like there's part of you that likes to keep things so you have more stuff to show, especially if you don't get to make a work all the time.
If you have
sell everything.
Yeah, if you only have photos where if someone could actually see there.
Yeah.
Especially the dress, is it going to be a different experience?
Yeah.
It's not like a painting where it's kind of going to be flat on a wall. Where
yeah,
if you're
it's
at
totally,
a photo,
it's totally
where the
different.
Dress is kind of an experience where you have to stand next to it to walk around it.
Yeah.
To, you know. Yeah.
So But it is funny. It is weird how you get so attached, and then it's like your children, you're like sending them off to college or something like that.
Well, and it's, yeah, and I think for me, I'm in a situation where I did mine as a charity thing. So I made 5 quilts, and I normally, and I don't even have room in my house, like wall space. Like I couldn't even put these up if I wanted to.
Yeah.
So I think this is actually very good for me to have created something that is going away.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've already committed to that. There's no turning back. Uh-huh. Like it is. It's gone. So I think that will help me next time, you know, next when I start, can do more work that's, I mean, I was working with donated neckties, so I didn't pick the fabrics or anything like that. So I'm very excited to start working on some new work that is going to be all whatever, like my own design, this was my own design, but just nothing
it's
contributed.
All
it's
you.
Like all going to be whatever I choose to work with. And to have it, just have the experience of giving everything away. Then if I start selling things, it's going to be, I'll be better equipped, I think, to be able to part with things.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had this just kind of a major, you know, exercise.
It was
in that.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm okay. You know, I'm okay. Yeah. So and not twitching or flinching or, you know, in convulsions. Yeah. So I'm going to be all right. So, but that's, I think that's a good, so you, people do get over the separation.
Yeah, I think
anxiety.
You just have to.
Otherwise, your house fills
up. You still have it a little bit. But, yeah, really, your house, I mean, especially...
when you're making big work.
Yeah. But I sometimes wish I just, like, had a flat file and all my work somehow fit in there, you know? I don't know. Or Marcel Duchamp has that little container of all of his pieces.
Oh, my gosh.
Have you seen it?
No.
It's like he has, like, you know, he signed a urinal, and that was, like, a very pivotal piece. He has a little miniature of that, and he has a stained glass piece called Bride Strip Bear by her, The Bachelor's Even. And so there's a miniature of that. There's just a miniature of all these icons of, you know, art history that he made.
Yeah.
And they all fit in this little case.
See, I like that approach.
It's really funny.
Yeah. Because it's, I'm a pack rat. I have all over my house. Like my life is pretty much a timeline of my life is in my house.
Uh-huh.
And
I say it whenever we give people a tour of our house. You know, when someone comes over the first time, you show them, like, this is this room, this is this room.
Right, right, right.
I'm like, and this is the creepy closet. And because I have this closet with all my felted characters.
Oh,
like
in
my
there. So
naked felted characters, kind of, and everything's just jammed in there. And you can see them, like, through this translucent plastic a little bit. And it's, like, these weird, they're all life-size. It's, like, these weird bodies standing up next to each other in a closet.
And they're
so,
like, what is going on?
But really, I am, you know, I do run out of space, so.
Yeah.
You know, I have a mop dress in my office right now, and I don't know where else to put it. So,
yeah. So, what can we expect next from you? What do you want to do?
Well, for the past couple months, I've been working on trying to think of smaller things I can do, actually, because the space is an issue, and for me, I've been working a lot of jobs, and so I haven't been having a lot of studio time, and I need to make some new work. So I have a new body of work to start proposing. So some of my pieces have been around Kansas City a couple times, and I feel like nobody wants to see them again, you know, which
right,
is probably more my attitude than anyone else's.
Right, because there's probably still people who haven't seen them.
But to me, they start to feel like old news. And so I've been experimenting with different kinds of paper clays and, like, paper mache things because they're lightweight. I can do it at my kitchen table. And I can make them, I can make smaller things with that.
Right.
So I've been working on different forms like that. One thing, I really liked felting when I was working larger. And the reason I liked it was because I could make these characters without seams.
Right.
Like when you sew something, there's always a seam, there's darts, all these things.
And
it feels like a
sometimes.
Doll.
Yeah.
It feels like I know there's stuffing in there. Where, like, felting, there's, because it's seamless, it seems more like it grew that way, like a regular figure,
right.
A regular person grows, you know? So, but what happened when I downsized the felt, it just got so cute, so fast.
Oh, and that's it not
seemed,
what you were going for.
Yeah, it just seemed more like a doll, but not in a positive way.
Right,
like
it wasn't what you were going for.
Yeah, it's like they either have to get extremely gruesome, or they have to get, you know, the material has to change because they're too stuffed animal. So so I've been working with this paper clay and making little figures, and I also have been buying up encaustic materials, and I'm liking this idea of using wax because you can scratch into it and it feels really translucent and it kind of seems skin-like. So oh, yeah. I'm right now working on dunking and, you know, working with wax and making these forms and I don't know.
Yeah, so what
I don't really know what's going to happen. So there I go again, trying a new material.
Yeah, well, it seems like that's, you're never going to be pigeonholed as one kind of.
That's a positive way.
Well, because the body of work that you, every time you like, okay, what else can I work with?
Yeah. And I think that's great. I just get attracted to things and I don't know, I just go for it.
Yeah, well, so. I think that's great. Because I think sometimes people have success, like, with the stress, it's successful, and then you might feel pressure to continue to make.
Yeah, I can't just keep braiding.
And then it gets kind of old. I mean, for you and maybe for your audience, might be like, okay, but you're going to keep changing it up, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So you're going to keep us in suspense to see what happens next.
And I also have been having the itch to do more 2D work again. And again, part of that thought is, you know, I am going to have to seize these little fragments of time that I have.
Right.
And so finding a way to get your ideas out and have some success, like making finished projects.
Without
you
taking.
Know, like, because I don't, like, if I finally shut off my computer at 10 o'clock at night, it's not like I'm like, okay, let's go weld something together. Or let's start, you know, this massive project outside in the garage right now.
Right,
you know, I just don't feel like it. And so trying to work on smaller things, I guess, that and things that I can maybe flat things, get my ideas out and like start developing and pushing and maybe turning back to that as a way to get the juices flowing, I guess, is what I've been thinking about. But who knows? I mean, if tomorrow when I'm driving back to Kansas, I get an idea for monumental or rug built on top of a house with a dress, I don't know. You know, I mean, I guess if I like the idea, if it really strikes me, I'll probably just forget everything I just said and make another massive thing I don't know where to put anyway.
Yeah. Well, I think things will work themselves out because I think you've gotten a really good reception here. I wish you all the success. And I think, you know, you don't need well-wishers. You're on your way. And it's really wonderful. But thank you for your time.
Thanks
for inviting me. A special thanks to Betsy for being such a great guest and sharing her story. I can't wait to see what Betsy comes up with next and hope to see her back here in Grand Rapids for Art Prize. If any of you are considering Art Prize as a potential goal on your list, I'll put the link to the Art Prize website. Go to craftsanity.com and I'll have a link. I believe there's a newsletter you can sign up for to get updates on the Art Prize registration timeframe and the venue pairing and all that good stuff. And I'd love to see more fiber artists in the competition and people who are using traditional craft techniques to make fine art. I think that would be really awesome to see more of that as well. So anyway, good luck to all of you who are considering it. And if I can be of any help, feel free to send me a note. Oh, one more thing I want to mention about Betsy that I forgot about. The Power and Light District Holiday Windows Competition is underway and Betsy is a part of it. She did a window display at Evolve Boutique at 1380 Main Street in Kansas City, Missouri. So if you are in the area, I hope that you can stop by and take a look at it. I'll also post a link to the Facebook photos that she has posted so you can kind of check out what she did. So she's always doing something, which is awesome. So good luck, Betsy, on the competition. That's running through December 16th, and the winner gets $5,000. I want to thank our sponsors once again for generously supporting this episode. I'd like to thank Kristen over at Craft Leftovers Monthly for supporting the show. You need to check out her zine. It's a cool one, and she does it all herself by hand. And as I mentioned before, it's filled with original projects, recipes, tips, stories, and crafty puzzles. And it's all about using what you have on hand and living a creative life. So I know I'm looking at a mound of stuff, of like supplies right now. My office is a complete disaster. Kristen is doing us all a service by helping us figure out what to do with the things in our stashes as opposed to going out and buying new stuff compulsively and piling it into our studios. So she's helping us out. So thanks, Kristen. And if you head over to craftleftovers.com/shop, you can find her current December issue and also all the back issues that she has available. So head over there and see what you've been missing. Yeah, and I forgot to mention, but Kristen was on episode 62 of the podcast. So if you want to hear my interview with Kristen, head to the archives and
download episode 62 in case you missed it, and you can hear Kristen's story and hear all about Kraft Leftovers and how it got started. I'd also like to thank Linda from tortugala.com, who has once again supported the podcast. She is a repeat sponsor, which I really appreciate. Thank you so much, Linda. She's also a contributor to Craft Sanity magazine. So if you want to see some of her handiwork, you can head over to craftsanity.com and, you know, snag a copy of the magazine and see what Linda has been doing. She did a really great illustration that's on page 3 that I really like, and we can embroider it, folks. That's a bonus. Total bonus here. I actually have an embroidery started of her illustration, which I think is really fun. She also did some printables for the magazine too. So there's like a stationery, a winter stationery, and also a weekly planner. So you can plan out your week in the coming year, you know, put some goals on your list each week that you want to get done, and have Linda help you get organized. And if you just kind of spend some time over on tortugala.com, you'll see not only her illustration and graphic art that she does, but also leather-bound journals that she makes. She also has a zine as well, and it's a really great art journaling zine, so you can check that out too. I'd also like to thank Sarah of Swell Cloth for supporting the podcast. I really appreciate it. Head over to swellcloth.etsy.com, where you'll find fabric, patterns, and notions for the modern sewist. The shop features lines from well-known designers, including Joel Dewberry, Amy Butler, Anna Maria Horner, and lots of others. So you can get everything from fabric bundles to patterns and just a lot of great stuff. So head over there and check it out. And because you're a Craft Sanity listener, you have special benefits. From now until the end of the month, you can receive 10% off your total purchase over at Swell Cloth. You just have to use the coupon code CSL10, and that's good through December 31st. So head over there and check out the shop. Special thanks to Kristen, Linda, and Sarah for supporting the podcast. Thanks so much, you guys. I really appreciate it. Without folks like them, it would be a lot harder for me to produce this podcast. So please support the people who support Craft Sanity. If you would like to become a sponsor of an upcoming show, feel free to contact us. You can send a message to jennifer@craftsanity.com or sponsors@craftsanity.com, whichever is easier for you to remember. And we'll get in contact and see what we can do to get you mentioned on the next episode. I'm going to move on to the after show and tell you about the magazine project I've been working on that I'm really excited about. So if you want to stick around and hear more about that, you're invited to do so. I'll be back soon with another episode of the podcast. The upcoming shows are going to feature people who are featured in the magazine. So you'll get kind of a behind the scenes look at the people who helped me make that first magazine a success. Knitting and crocheting are a couple of the topics we'll be discussing. We're also going to discuss cooking for the first time ever on Craft Sanity. I'm really excited about that because I am one of these people who longs to have more time in my schedule to be able to cook more. So stay tuned for those upcoming shows. In the meantime, Craft Sanity, my friends, it works for me. Well, thanks for sticking around for the after show. Just wanted to give you a little update. The first issue of Craft Sanity magazine is going to be available on Tuesday, December 7th. It's going to be sold. It's as a PDF download for $3.99 or print copy for $12. Yeah, I'm really excited for you guys to see this. It's a project I've been wanting to do for years, and finally just, I didn't really have time to do it. You know, it's one of those things where I'm like, oh my gosh, how am I going to do this? I just did it. I did it anyway. So, and I am so happy that I did because I learned so much from this experience. I thought I knew something about print publishing since I was, you know, I spent my entire adult life writing for print publications, and but there was quite a learning curve, and my next issue I think is going to go a lot smoother. The intention is for it to be a quarterly publication, and I cover all art and craft forms, so nothing is really off the table because Craft Sanity is not just about one kind of art or craft. I like them all, and I'm interested in them all, so the door's wide open there. The first issue is kind of, I wanted to have kind of a cozy feel because here in the States, I know we're in winter, and I realize you folks in Australia and others on the other side of the globe are, you know, gearing up for your warm summer. So, you know, but there's something that, you know, you guys could, I think, still be interested in this publication. In fact, I have Sarah London from Australia contributing her granny stars, which are fantastic. She's a prolific crocheter, and I've been a big fan of her work for a long time. So I'm thrilled to have her in this issue. I keep calling them episodes because I'm used to doing podcasts. But anyway, also we get a peek inside the famous knitter's notebook, the notebook that belongs to Debbie Bliss. I recently interviewed her, and I'll be sharing that on the podcast soon. I interviewed Sarah London, so you'll hear from her on the podcast soon. Also, Anna from Mochi Mochi. She just had a show in New York, and she knits in very miniature little scenes, but very expansive. She'll do like a gigantic installation with such detail that it's unbelievable. Well, her snowman pattern for mini snowmen, these little snowmen are about 1.5 inches tall. There's also a recipe for very, very delicious graham crackers. And just a warning, if you make these, you're probably never going to want to eat store-bought graham crackers ever again. So just, you know, be cautious about that. Yeah, and there's a paper craft in there. There's a paper doll. There's gift tags. All kinds of good stuff. And if you go to craftsanity.com and click on, it's a pretty recent post. I did a preview on TV recently. And while the segment didn't go as smooth as I would have liked, it'll give you an idea of what this magazine is all about. I brought project samples to show on TV. And what the viewers could not see is that my daughter was with me, my 5-year-old Amelia, my youngest. She was off camera, like sitting in a chair. But right before we started the live shot, she was kind of not really going with the program. She didn't want to sit down, and I was very nervous because I'm like, oh no, what is going to happen? And it's only like 4.5-5 minute segment, but you know, if a kid knocks something down on the set, or I mean, I just was like, oh gosh. So it was one of those situations where it could have gone either way, but she did finally just settle down and watch the segment. I did my thing, and she watched, and when I got done, it was hilarious. Before the segment started, she was like the typical 5-year-old, like not necessarily wanting to cooperate, and then the segment ends, and I'm like, okay, we got through it. She didn't break anything. She didn't like walk through the shot. I mean, everything went pretty smooth considering, you know, the challenges. And then at the end, she says, Mom, that was great. That was really great. You did great. And it was hilarious. She was like in producer mode after, you know, just being 5 and not really wanting to cooperate beforehand. So anyway, it was kind of funny. But the stories, I'm convinced that what happens behind the scenes of all these segments, the crazy frenzy that happens, like I was up till 2 a.m. the night before making Anna's little snowmen. And they're so cute, these things, seriously. They're like addictive to make. Well, so I stayed up really late to make a couple because I don't have samples. I just had some photos Anna sent me for the publication. So I'm like, man, I got to get on this and knit these. And they're easy. It's an easy pattern and really fun. So that was no problem. The only problem was that during the segment, I didn't get the chance to like direct the viewer to the snowman that I worked so hard on the night before. And this is totally typical. This happens every time I do a segment. I like stay up later to finish one extra thing. And then we don't get to it. So it's like one of these days I got to learn, you know, how to just get some sleep so I don't seem like because I'm always exhausted when I do the segments. I barely can remember my name. I'm not that tired. I mean, I'm safe enough to drive, but I'm like not exactly ready to take the SATs. You know what I mean? I mean, so it's been an adventure. But yeah, the magazines was put together by my husband and I. And right about the time we entered the production phase for the magazine, my husband's things got a little crazy at work where more people were let go. So it's a horribly sad time for print journalism to see people, you know, you've worked with for years losing their jobs. And my husband is still holding on to his job. However, it became all the more intense because now there are less people and there's more work to do. And, you know, he's been working a lot of overtime. So the poor guy would come home and I would be like, oh, yeah, so can you help me with the magazine tonight? You know, and we pulled a lot of late nights to try to get it done, and we ended up about 2 weeks behind schedule just because, I mean, it just was so hard to get it done with his schedule. So obviously that's something that we don't anticipate this being a chronic problem. You know, for the next issue, I think I'll be able to plan out from publication date and things will go a lot smoother. So we have that first one done, and I'm really excited for you to see it. And if there's any, I'm rambling on and on, but like, I guess the thing that I really want to get across is that I hope that, you know, you'll take a look at this and see what you can contribute, because I would love to see this, you know, eventually over time. I want to include work from so as many people as I can. I think it'd be great to have the publication kind of evolve with the help of the readers, and because you guys are people who make things, and it's a different environment than, you know, if I'm writing a general newspaper article, because you guys are creative types and makers, people who like to make stuff. And if you have a project you'd like to share, or pattern or tutorial, send it in. You can send it to me, Jennifer@craftsanity.com, or go on my contact, click the contact tab. If you have a sample you want to send in, you can mail that to me. My P.O. Box address is there. And yeah, just get in contact. I do have, for those who create original work for the magazine specifically, I do pay for contributions. I mean, it's not very much, but I'll just be upfront about that. But it definitely is a great way to get some exposure for your blog or your book or whatever else you're doing. And I basically pay the rate that I've been paid by other publications to do work. So I currently do work for the same pay rate. So I'm not trying to rip anybody off, but at the same time, I'm trying to also not incur great personal debt for this craft publication. Pre-sales have been really great. To my surprise, I never know what's going to happen. You know, I never expected to do 100 and some podcasts. And I have not sold any subscriptions at this point. I've just been selling the first issue. And I'm doing that. I made the choice to just sell it one issue at a time right now, because I want to make sure that it's something that you guys want to see a second issue of, you know, before I start collecting people's money for an entire year. So I want to be kind of go into this with my eyes open, see what kind of response I get before I lock us all into four issues for the year. But my intention is to have a seasonal, you know, winter, spring, summer, fall. And I want to see what happens next. But check it out. Let me know what you think. And like I said, there's a special pre-order special going on right now. So if you can, I'm going to leave that pre-order special up through the day's end tomorrow, which is Monday, December 6th. And then everything's going to be shipped out. All the orders that have come in will be shipped out by Tuesday. If depending on what time I get it tomorrow, I might be able to get some things shipped tomorrow. And I'll be delivering to local retailers. It's amazing. Local retailers are going to carry the magazine. And so you better believe that I'm going to be out there taking pictures and Schuler books and local yarn shops of the magazine on the shelf, just because, you know, I get excited about things like that. And I'm one step closer to publishing a book, which is really exciting, because I'm kind of using this magazine publication as kind of an experiment to see, okay, so what does it take to self-publish something? And would I want to do this again? And, you know, I haven't totally decided, you know, that I would self-publish as opposed to going with a publisher. But I'm starting to think that self-publishing doesn't seem as daunting as it used to. So, yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens next. But, I'm excited about my future projects, and hope to work with as many of you as possible on those projects. So anyway, I've rambled on long enough, and I'm going to try to get back to work. So there's a lot to be done in the next couple of days. And I'd love to hear your feedback on the magazine and hear what you think. And, you know, because I'm not going to launch any subscriptions until I know that you guys really want to see another issue. So, I'm not going to lie. I am planning a second issue. Just because I love this stuff. So planning a second issue. But obviously, if the market does not want a second issue, then it might just be an online thing. So we'll see what happens. But thanks again for all of you who, I've been amazed by the number of people who have pre-ordered a copy of this thing that you've never seen before. So thank you for trusting that I'm actually, you know, capable of doing this magazine. I appreciate that. And it's really gratifying, because most of the issues that I've sold, you know, the pre-order sales have been, they're scattered around the world and across the country. And that is just really so awesome. And thank you so much for supporting what I do, because if you didn't, you know, I wouldn't be sitting here, you know, talking to this microphone, sitting at my kitchen table across the table from my husband with, you know, our laptops out making a magazine. I mean, we wouldn't have an audience. So thank you so much for all the support and encouragement. I really appreciate it. I'd just like to mention really quickly that Briar Rose Fibers
was the big yarn sponsor for the first issue of Craft Sanity. So you'll see a lot of yarn from Briar Rose. It's a local West Michigan company. Chris hand dyes, or she actually hand paints yarn and roving, and it's really wonderful to work with. And she's actually having a special through December 15th, and you can go to briarrosefibers.net, and when you place your order, if you type in holiday as the coupon code, you can save 10% off your purchases by December 15th. So I just want to pass that on. We already did a giveaway on the blog for some gift certificates. So Chris has been a big supporter of this first issue, and I really appreciate that, because I couldn't show her sample pages of the magazine or anything. It was basically blind faith that she jumped into this, and it's been wonderful to have her on board. So if you're looking for some last minute Christmas gifts, I think this is probably a good gift for yourself, actually. This yarn is fun. You can head over to briarrosefibers.net and snag some yarn. So anyway, okay. Well, with that said, I'm going to let you go, and I'm going to get back to work so I can hurry up and get this podcast out and come back with another one very soon. So everyone have a great week, and I'll be back as soon as I can. Thanks a lot for tuning in.